Coming up, my interview with UK rock critic Barney Hoskins and his new bio on Tom Waits. Next on the Dusty Wright Show at culturecatch.com. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Sony Pro. For all of your HDNA needs, visit pro.sony.com. Barney, welcome. Welcome to America.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Low Side of the Road, what's your earliest memory of Tom Waits?
I think my earliest memory, it's not a particularly, interesting one, was reading Time Out, the original UK version, circa probably 75, and seeing this guy in the slouch cap and the kind of jazz bow threads and Nighthawks at the Diner. I was probably 14 and trying to understand what this meant, What did it mean relative to, The Grateful Dead or David Bowie? Who was this throwback? And I didn't know much about Jack Kerouac or any of that or jazz. So I just, but it was intriguing, Who is this Tom Waits? He's clearly not just another chip off the singer-songwriter block.
What was it with his music that resonated with you? So circa 75, I'm guessing you were probably into Queen and the glam.
How
the
dare you?
The Slade.
I was coming out of glam. No, I was already into American music.
Okay.
Bearded American music was interesting to me.
Were you a deadhead?
I was never a deadhead, but I did like the Grateful Dead and their kind. The band was my big passion, and I later wrote a book about the band. The band was my window into that world of sort of backwoods Americana, I suppose. But I did see the Dead and so Waits, I didn't really start listening to Waits properly until a little later on, really. And then I worked back, not being a jazz head. I didn't sort of understand what Waits meant. And the guy who really made me take Waits seriously, funny enough, was Nick Cave, who I ran around with in the early 80s. Cave was a big Waits fan. Mm. And so he was playing Blue Valentine and, Foreign Affairs and things like that. And I was surprised that he liked this music, but it really made me. And then the next thing was just sort of One from the Heart and Swordfish Trombones and just waking up to this giant talent. And so I was, actually comparatively late to the Waits cult.
Yes, there's the whole, he had this Southern California singer-songwriter, quasi-jazzbo initially, Closing Time, obviously the Eagles borrowed Old 55 and probably made him a good bundle of money with that cover. And then the Nighthawks was, I guess, the turning point. Closing Time had elements of jazz, I guess.
Yes.
But he didn't really turn the corner until Nighthawks. Is that correct?
I think Heart of Saturday Night, 1974, is where there's a more pronounced jazz feel. I mean, the story is such as that David Geffen liked Closing Time, but thought that Tom needed a producer to bring out the jazz flavor a bit more. So Bones Howe came in. Bones Howe's background was, his big success was with very, not jazz things like The Fifth Dimension, so he was more kind of pop, but he had produced or engineered albums by everyone from Sinatra to Ornette Coleman. So he had jazz chops and had been a jazz drummer himself. And so Bones and Tom, kind of formed this partnership that they endured for the rest of the 70s. But Nighthawks at the Diner, the double live 1975 record, was overtly, jazzy and scatty and the whole sort of comedy thing that was going on there. And I think that was just too jazzy for David Geffen. It was just taking the jazz thing one step too far.
And Geffen had such success with Joni Mitchell, and he had all these people on his Asylum label that were really, I'm sure they were just lining his pockets with tons of cash. And then here comes Waits, who's this enigma, the next kind of artist, true artist, defied classification in some ways. Wasn't Nighthawks one of the first, as I recall when I first got the record, it was one of the first records cut live in a studio with a small audience, like a real boutique audience. Of course, jazz was always cut live in the studio. That's how guys played, they'd play 17 takes of a track and get 17 different versions. But for that, that was kind of revolutionary for rock record, even though it truly wasn't rock and roll.
I mean, it was somewhere between, you know, a true, authentic live recording and a slightly prearranged thing. I mean, they had an invited audience. It was all kind of probably set up. So it was a sort of simulacrum of a kind of, you know, late night, you know, club experience, if you like. And I think they did maybe, I think they did two sets one night and two sets the following night, and then they took the best of the recordings from that. And I still think it's one of the funniest records ever made.
It's amazing.
You know, just on a kind of comedic level, it's genius.
I remember the guy that lived next door to me, he was a big music freak like myself. And his family got the New York Times. So in Akron, Ohio, you know, the family on the block had the Times. Like, that was a cool family. And he had read, I don't know who had written a review, but, you know, we read the review. We both dashed out to buy this record. You know, that's what you did in those days. We didn't have 17 distractions like our kids do today. You know, you lived around the vinyl release and that double record and the gatefold. And you're right. It was just like, wow. You know, for a young, impressionable mind who was being numbed to death by Zeppelin and prog rock and all the indulgences of English rock, it was a whole different animal. I want to ask you, and I didn't ask you last night, nor did anyone else, how influential was Ricky Lee Jones to Tom's music, or vice versa? You know, who came first, the chicken or the egg? Were they both simultaneously running in parallel with their sounds?
It's a good question. I think that Tom was the bigger influence on Ricky Lee, for sure. Ricky Lee was already tilting in a sort of, you know, jazz, boho direction. I think she already had that together, but I think she said that, I think she put it like this, that she adopted some of Waits's swagger. I think her, you know, her chief model was probably Laura Nero, with a bit of Van Morrison in there, and then she did feed off what Waits had achieved at that point, and I don't know that, I think, you know, Waits found her tremendously stimulating company, and in his mind he was recreating some sort of relationship out of the pages of Charles Bukowski, you know, with Ricky Lee, you know, and they did stumble along Santa Monica Boulevard, you know, drunk out of their minds with Chucky Weiss, and it was sort of living out some idea of a kind of Kerouac, Neil Cassidy, menage a trois. At the end of the day, I don't think Waits could handle just how wild Ricky Lee was. I mean, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I
Tom
always
had
thought
his,
it was just the opposite.
But. No, Tom had his problems with alcohol, but Ricky Lee actually was a more damaged soul. Mm. And she, you know, she got into some pretty heavy drugs, which Waits never did. Waits stopped short of doing the whole junkie thing. Mm-hmm. He could have done, but I think he had enough self-preservation instinct to say, you know, actually, I don't want to go down that road. I don't trust myself to go down that road.
Hmm. Interesting. I never thought of it. And I guess, you know, we're so used to every rock and roll hero having gone down that path. You just assume that, oh, well, you know, brilliant songwriter, heroin, what must have been in the mix somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it's good to know that he was able to curb that demon, as it would. So the big turning point musically is New York, Swordfish Trombone. What do you think propelled him into that direction? I mean, you lay it out beautifully in the book, but you know, we just want to tease the audience a little bit. You can get more in-depth when you read it at home, folks.
Swordfish Trombones was actually done in Los Angeles before he moved east to New York. Yeah, it was like one of the last things he did before uprooting with wife and child.
And it was a label change as well, Barney?
It was a label change, okay. Yeah. He got tired of being what we call a prestige artist on Elektra Asylum and being part of that West Coast thing. And they couldn't get their heads around the new songs that he was doing, the Swordfish Trombone songs. They thought he'd gone mad, I think. And so Chris Blackwell basically stepped in and said, you know, I love this. It's different. It's completely berserk. And it fits perfectly on Island Records, you know. So he had a new home. And I think he felt, you know, very validated at Ireland, and it was good. It was good for a while. So Swordfish was, you know, there's that startling year when One From the Heart comes out, the soundtrack comes out, and it's very much in that. I mean, he was already wanting to leave that behind, and then Coppola says, I need you to go back there and do that again for this movie, and I want you to write the songs, and I'm going to base the film around your music. And so just as Waits is about to abandon that whole style at the piano, and he has to go back and revisit it and rework it. And I'm thank God he did, because I think it's one of his greatest records and some of his most beautiful songs.
I agree with you. Yeah. And I just the fact that he used Crystal Gayle, who in those days was a huge pop star. You know, you just that pairing is just so unimaginable looking backwards. Like, how did, you know, you think of a lot of different singer-songwriters he could have partnered with. But
yes.
Oh, wait, was that Coppola's idea? Was that
actually, interesting, it was Kathleen Brennan's suggestion.
Really?
It was Tom's wife, who had heard her sing Cry Me a River.
Mm.
And I think Kathleen's instinct was a very good one, which was, you know, if we get a characterful jazz chanteurs to sing with Tom, it's almost like two very similar entities. What we need to sort of complement Tom's, you know, grainy growl is we need a very pure voice. And she'd heard this version of Cry Me a River, and it was just a suggestion. They flew her in, and the blend was just perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was like Beauty and the Beast, you know. Crystal was not a jazz singer, but actually she just sang. She sang straight and pure. And I think for the material, it worked so well. I think it was inspired, actually. Mm,
I agree. I quite agree. It is one of my favorite Tom Waits albums, even though I have all of them. I like most of them. What was the most surprising thing about this book for you? What was the big discovery moment? I mean, obviously, you researched heavily. You've interviewed them. You know, you've interviewed tons of people, 40-plus people for the book.
70.
70 people.
You have to say that.
70.
It was actually 70. I actually got to count it the other day. And I just, because some people said, because I make a deal about, you know, the few people who wouldn't talk, I thought, you know, it's important to make it clear that I actually did
speak to
like
three of
people.
His ex-friends. Yeah. 70.
Yeah,
yeah.
So 72 interviews I realized I did. Some of them were just like, I don't know, Sadie Frost had been in the Dracula movie with him. And so was living, you know, cheek by jowl with him and Keanu Reeves for a few weeks there at Coppola's place in
Napa. What
a
great
role
he was in that movie.
So she had some interesting things. But, you know, so there are, you know, people are only incidentally intersected with Waits along the way, but a lot of them were people who'd known him very well. What was the question again?
What was the big
one? The honest answer to that is I don't think anything contradicted the gut feelings that I'd always had about Tom Waits. So my just core feeling about who he was, and having interviewed him and, you know, spent a little bit of time with him, were confirmed, you know, right. And those feelings were, he is just a fascinating mixture of ferocity and tenderness, and he's a good man, and he's a smart man who slightly disguises his own intelligence with that kind of bumbling, I don't know, you know, but once he gets going, he's extremely eloquent and articulate fellow, man with a big heart, tremendous curiosity about people, great empathy, feeling of you know, wanting to, something about this idea of the kind of renegade American artist, the renegade maverick, and we gravitate towards that kind of an artist, you know, and maybe here you take them a little more for granted. I don't know, or they just like, so what? Not so what, but just, well, you know, what, tell me something I don't know. I don't know. In England, Waits tells us something we didn't know. He told us something we didn't know.
Well, it's interesting. You know, New York is never a fair barometer for the rest of America either with culture. You know, we'd like to think we're the epicenter of culture. And perhaps when Tom lived here, you know, we embraced him even more than we did earlier. And then he became like part of us, like any musician who spends time here. But, you know, as he's gotten more interesting musically, I seem to feel like you know, maybe he's lost more fans than he had initially. I don't know. What do you think about that? You know, the last couple of records, with the exception of Orphans, which I just think is wonderful, just being able to grab all those B-sides and everything and make this incredibly sprawling, genius record. The last few records before were not easy listens, even though I personally love them, but from a, you know, a template of pop radio.
I think his sales worldwide have increased, and he has a really broad fan base now of kind of people from all walks of life and all ages and so forth. Those records aren't. The more sort of European records are not easy listening by any stretch of the imagination. But I think he's just become he's like an NPR favorite now. You know,
the barometer for all smart culture. Yeah. Culture Catch and NPR. I always say we're the edgier NPR. I don't know if that makes any sense, but we're younger. No, but that's interesting. It is. You know, you certainly will hear his music as bumper music or segue music, than you will something else. Who are the young artists in your mind that Tom will pass the torch to, or who are paying homage to his canon of work?
Well, I think among the very younger artists today, I mean, I'm probably not aware of the ones who would cite Waits' influence. But going back a few years, you know, you've got to look at people like Beck, PJ Harvey, and Mark Linkous of Sparkle Horse, and to a lesser degree, the guys in Primus that he worked with, Les Claypool, and so forth. I think Waits is an elder statesman who's forever young.
Right.
You know, he is like, you know, the eccentric sort of uncle or kind of grandfather who, you know, who stays very young in spirit, who, you know, and offers a version of young at heart that apparently Kathleen thought was hysterical. You know, you're an old codger, you're not young at heart, apparently she said. But, I mean, he is young at heart, and much like a Neil Young, he's very determined not to go gently into that good night, and he fights very hard not to be reactionary. He tries to embrace things that his peers are threatened by. You know, he embraced punk rock, he embraced hip hop. He's curious at how he can keep pace with these new developments. So, I think he had a lot to do with the sound of the 90s. I think the records he made in the 80s were really showed the way for artists to go. There was such a reaction against the awful overproduced synthetic music in the 80s, and come the 90s, I think there were a whole, you know, the swathes of artists who took Swordfish, Trombones, and Rain Dogs as their kind of cue for making, you know, quirky lo-fi records that were, you know, mic'd organically, and there was a real sort of, you know, they wanted that organic feel to the sound, and they were bringing in all these, you know, battered old instruments and harmoniums and octagons and all of that stuff. I think Waits had a lot to do with that. You know, when he made Swordfish Trombones, you know, artists like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell were using drum machines,
right?
So I think he's the kind of king of sort of lo-fi, if you like, organic sounding, you know, Americana. He had a lot to do with.
That's a good point, Barney. Very good point. I didn't think of it. And you're absolutely right. So many eras are defined by the technology. And, you know, we always look fondly, I guess, on music that is the most organic. We look back to the 60s and the R&B sound, jazz, and, you know, the real organic rock and roll. And then when the 80s and 90s, when everything got synthed out, you know, you might look at something like a Devo track and say, oh, you know, they utilized it in a clever way. But a lot of that stuff is just so disposable. You just, you
know. I mean, I love electronic music when it's used in a sort of, you know, raw, barbaric way, if you like.
Sure.
When it's not clean.
Right.
And, you know, Devo used electronics. Very interesting. It's Suicide, obviously, here in New York.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You know, when it's You know, and I even love the way, you know, acts like Daft Punk have used, you know, electronic dance forms. And but when it's just in, you know, serving the end of a kind of clean, polished sort of veneer of sort of oral elegance, then I think it's monstrous, really. And there are an awful lot of records made in the 80s that just sound so sterile and dead.
Oh, that's my one fault with Prince. As genius as he was as a songwriter, I listen to his music, it sounds so incredibly dated to me. And I always thought, God, I wish he would do like a really organic record. Bass guitar, drums.
Well, like
he
could play everything. Dirty Mind, of course, was fantastically organ. I mean, it's just like 8-track demos,
right?
Basically.
And that, to me, stands the test of time.
It's my favorite Prince album.
Yeah, tracks from some of the other records, Sign of the Times. There's some tracks on that, and Some Days It Snows in April. You know, I can pick out tracks from certain records where he just went lo-fi, that he probably just was in the studio and just threw it down. But and there are other artists as well. I don't mean to, you know, pick on Prince because he's a terrific songwriter, sure. But there are a lot of artists that I feel get trapped by. I guess they got trapped by the excess of record production and budgets and all that other crap. Tom never really had the luxury. I mean, not with Anti Records. I guess, you know, he's got his own home studio. He can just cobble together anything he wants, and it's, you know, it's as good as anything you'll ever hear in a huge studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they exist. I mean, you know, these huge studios are becoming extinct.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the first, again, to sort of say, I don't want to record in the studio. I want to kind of drag the equipment down the hill to this little shed that's just down there at the end of the lane. And I want the doors thrown open. I don't want this, you know, cocooned chamber. I want, you know, if there's a plane going over, hell, let's have that sound in the background, you know. And so it's just a way of, you know, really, it's a refreshing way of thinking.
I spoke to somebody who was in, they were in Santa Monica, I forget which album Tom was recording, one of the Anti records, and he said that Tom was in the B studio, they had the big A studio, and, you know, he's curious to see how they were miking everything, and, you know, they had happened to be walking out at lunch at the same time, and Waits was, you know, really trying to get a sound on a vocal take that he just couldn't figure out, and, you know, he's really scratching his head, and this engineer had made a suggestion to try something, and you know, Tom kind of looked at him, and he came back, and he peeked in the studio, and I guess Tom had taken his mic, and I just love this story, and put it inside a guitar case, and had just opened the case like maybe 2 inches, and was singing into the mic like that, like kind of laying on the floor, just to get a different sound, a different texture, a different EQ, which I just think is wonderful, you know?
Absolutely.
To your point about, like, leave the barn doors open.
You know, absolutely.
What's your favorite story in the book? Of all the interviews you've done, was there something you had to leave out that you thought, oh, God, you know, I'll be, you know, they'll be shooting at me?
I don't think I left out too much. I'm trying to remember if there were any stories that we thought. I mean, there were things, you know, had a pretty thorough legal read, as you might imagine. So there were phrases or insinuations or so forth, but I don't think it was anything kind of major that we had to drop out of it. I mean, I love the story that I mentioned last night in the reading of you know, Nicolas Cage taking Waits around to meet Ozzy Osbourne, his next door neighbor.
That's a great story. Please share that with the audience. Well, I love this story.
Well, there isn't much of a story other than just the notion of Waits having tea with Ozzy and then... And the conclusion to the story is Waits then seeing the Osbournes on MTV, you know, like 2-3 months later, and being absolutely mortified. Appalled that anyone could, you know, open up their lives in this way and allow their. I mean, obviously, there's a Heisenberg principle at work here, which is at the moment there's a camera in the room, you behave differently from how you would behave. So it's a show. It's not like it's cinema verite, but
it's not like the Loud Family on PBS.
I never saw that, and I wish I had. You know, that's a fascinating
be on
story.
Yeah.
No, I really I should look into that. I think Lance Loud's story is a really interesting one. But
no, you're so right about that. The camera's on and. As you so eloquently write it, you know, Waits is like Dylan, you know, he's very private. He doesn't want his family life exposed. You don't need to know about his children and his domestic situation.
He is, as I said last night, he is, I think, the defining anti-celebrity of our age. You know, he has no interest in serving up his life for, you know, public consumption or as, you know, I think this is the awful kind of trap that everyone's fallen into of late. Is you're selling your life and your scandals and your heartbreaks and your rehabs as much as anything else. It becomes the overall part of what you're selling. It's just grotesque to me, you know. And this is why, you know, artists like Amy Winehouse have fallen afoul of this. They've run aground on this, and it's tragic. They can't they can't separate their lives from their work.
In some instances, it fuels their work to great effect. Pete Doherty's released, I think, the best record of his career.
Right.
And, you know, the guy has just been stumbling through the promise of something brilliant.
It just takes a very strong artist to ignore all the mythological nonsense that accrues around him.
Right.
You know, to be able to say it's all bullshit and I've got nothing to do with it. I'm just going to stay on course with what I'm doing. I'm not going to read any of the stuff about myself and I'm not going to respect it or pay any real attention to it. Because I will go insane if I do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, you talk to that point. When I first met Robert Plant, I was amazed at how casual he was with me and how so unmyth-like he was, being the atypical rock god of all time.
He's a very rare case of someone who has never believed anything that's been written about him. Just as, you know, I mean, I once asked him, I said, how come you didn't move to LA and go nuts in a Bel Air mansion? You know, he said, because actually I just wanted to stay in the area where I grew up with the people who really knew me. You know, who knew me before I was Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin. And I just knew instinctively that was the way to survive all of this and to stay sane and to stay humble was to stay around the people who knew me who really knew me, rather than just around all the fantasy and nonsense that fame encourages. So, you know, I think, you know, Robert is a fantastic example of someone who kind of knows who he is and is able to separate it from the legend of Zeppelin and all the nonsense and the mud sharks and the Starship One. And, you know, he knows his ley lines.
Everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see the influence of all that Zeppelin through his historical perspective. Yeah. But the thing that was remarkable, we started talking about American music, and I told him I love the Birds, and what do you think of Love? And I love Love. And how about Moby Grape? Oh, yeah, I love Moby Grape. He goes, well, I've got Jerry Miller's phone number. Let's call him right now. And he proceeds to dial him, you know, to say, you know, he's hanging out with a journalist from America. We're talking about Moby Grape. And he was so excited about that. There was a journalist that really appreciated Moby Grape.
Yeah, he had just read a little book I'd written on Arthur Lee when I met him. I was just so thrilled that, you know, that Robert Plant had been reading my words, you know. And then the second time I interviewed him, it was just such a thrill. He picked me up at this station, you know, in Wales. It was just him, on the platform. I assumed he was going to send some lackey to come and get me. And there he was, you know. And I knew we were near Bron Roar, the famous cottage where he and Jimmy wrote, you know, the songs for Led Zeppelin 3 and the acoustic stuff. And I said, we couldn't swing by Bron Roar, could we? So he took me up to Bron Roar, and he said, well, let's see whether anyone's home. Maybe we can just creep up and maybe they won't be there. And they weren't. So we just wandered around Bron Roar, took pictures of Robert leaning against the cottage door. It was to me, it was just like,
doesn't get any better, does it?
No, he didn't get much better than that. Yeah. And he's just such a nice man. Good man, a really good man.
Yeah, he really is.
These are the people that, you know, that should be emulated. You know, not the Axl Roses of this world. You know.
Well, you didn't like Chinese Democracy? What are you saying, Barney? Come on, man. 10 years to create a masterpiece?
No comment. I'm going to have to hit the road.
All right. Yeah, you know, what I'd love to do is next time you're through, or if I get to the UK, let's do part two about just our love of music and
fantastic.
Just chat about all of that.
I'd love to do that.
I really, you know, it's rare that you find a book that is a page turner as a bio, unless you really love the artist, unless you're a huge Psycho fan, you know. But your book, Low Side of the Road, the Tom Waits story, is just extraordinary. It comes out next Tuesday. Hopefully this podcast will be up just as the book's hitting the bookstores. And I encourage all of you out there, even if you don't know Tom's music, this is a wonderful way to really appreciate his entire canon of work, which is so incredibly rich and worth investigating. Anyway, Barney Hoskins, thanks so much for being on the Dusty Wright Show.
Thank you, Dusty. A pleasure to talk with you.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Mr. Barney Hoskins. Today's show was edited by Mr. Julian Siegler. If you like our brand of smart culture, please leave your comments in the iTunes directory. And check us out daily at culturecatch.com for all of your smart culture needs. This is Dusty Wright for the Dusty Wright Show. Converge is the word.
Influencing the influencers. Smart culture. CultureCatch.com.